This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Among Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Khoo Kay Kim's many accomplishments was working on crafting our very own Rukun Negara. The renowned historian, who recently turned 80, has, somewhat reluctantly, penned his memoirs with the help of his eldest son, Edin Khoo. They both join me now to discuss the reason behind publishing the book, which is titled IKKK, The Autobiography of a Historian, while also sharing some stories from Professor Khoo's illustrious life. Welcome, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very good, thanks.
Fine.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's such an honour. And I mean, just to start off with, the first chapter of your book kicks off with the line, "Truth be told, autobiographical reflection goes against all the cultivated instincts of a trained historian." So was this autobiography not your idea then?
Well, we don't usually write about ourselves. We write about others. And when it comes to writing about oneself, I think it is very difficult.
I can only imagine.
It's easy to be blunt when you talk about other people, but to talk about yourself, you can't help but hide certain things.
But then I suppose, you know, who got you to do it? What prompted you in the end to finally put down all your memories to paper?
Edin.
Edin looks very pleased with himself. I just need to say that.
No, I think actually it's something, I think it's his parents. I think it's increasing remembrance of his parents. And a lot of the autobiography was around that, revolved around that.
I suppose then how ready were you to dig deep, you know, to peel back, you know, all your own insecurities and, you know, reveal so much about your personality and life to such a public sphere?
Being an academic and being so involved in writing about various other personalities, of course, I can't help but examine myself from time to time. And a lot of what happened in the past, I could remember very well. So I have kept that with me. And sometimes I ask myself certain questions, you know, whether I did the right thing or I could have done better if I'd done something else. Even the choice of career, you see, it was very often a result of accident that I decided to pick on something.
But I think that's the case with most of us, isn't it? The title of the book itself, IKKK, that's a very very attention-grabbing, very eyebrow-raising title. Why was this chosen?
Well, I will take the consequences. I will accept the consequences for that. Only because I think the name itself, Khoo Kay Kim, is a name that has great history. In the sense that it comes from a particular lineage, it comes from a particular clan, it comes from a particular clan house, the Khoo Kong Si,
yes.
Which is very well known. And of course, they have a whole tradition of naming generations. The other reason for KKK was that it has often been used for people who either want to use the voice of my father to advance a certain point of view,
okay,
or people who criticize him. So it's always KKK sabut or KKK said.
Really?
And I thought it would be a nice irony to play on that. I know it's inferences to the American history.
Very dark part of American
dark part
history.
Of American history. But really, I think, you know, that's a matter of coincidence above all else. Mainly, it's the fact that it is a lineage name,
mm-hmm,
and the fact that he's often, whether praised or criticized, the initials are used, KKK. It also plays nicely on the tongue.
It does. It rules off very nicely. It's just, I suppose, the association with that American group that we were talking about, but we shan't talk about that. And Professor, I imagine that, you know, you really had to go back to places of your childhood and, you know, live there again to sort of get all of this story onto the page. How difficult was that for you? I mean, had you already sort of informally kept a record of all of this?
Yes, I'm always very aware, and I sort of relate the past in my mind from time to time. I suppose I can't help it, since history is my profession. And then whenever something happens today, I tend to compare it with what I personally had experienced before.
Of course.
For example, when people talk of May 69, I always try to tell them that May 69 was nothing compared to what I went through at the end of 1945. When there were very severe clashes from Batu Pahat right up to Perak,
yeah, yep,
between they usually say Chinese and Malays, but actually it was not Chinese and Malays. Between a group of Malays called Banja, and then Chinese who were actually mostly communists, who created trouble, you see. Mm-hmm. So the situation was very complicated, and Malaysians today, of course, don't really remember what it was like. And then people forget also, throughout the 60s, there were ethnic conflicts in Penang. Nobody talks about that. No. But because Kuala Lumpur has always been the center of the Malay Peninsula, so people tend to zero in on Kuala Lumpur. 69 situation was not that bad, actually, comparatively.
Comparatively, yeah. But I suppose there was a lot of, it was a turning point for the country's history as well. So maybe that's...
Politicians use that sometimes.
Exactly.
Excuse, yeah.
So, I mean, the book consists of memories, you know, as all autobiographies do. How did you then decide, you know, which of your memories to include and why tell your story now?
Well, I had a lot of discussions with Edin. And it is always easier for me when somebody questions me. If I have to pick and choose from the past, it becomes a bit difficult. Mm-hmm. But if somebody were to ask me questions, then that was his role. He asked me a lot of questions, which made it easier for me to relate the past.
So everything was there, just needed the prompting. Mm-hmm. So Edin, then how did you sort of frame it? How did you tackle this, really?
Well, I first of all, I think a lot of the compulsion came from the fact that I think of all his sons, I am the closest to my father. I spent a lot of time with him as a young boy. You know, he was very involved in things like national unity talks and things like this. He would go to Taiping and Tapa and Telok Anson, and he would always take me along. And we would talk about lots of things. I remember things very clearly as well. But my father, I think, is enigmatic, even to the public, but also to his family. So much of this has been about exploring family, because I wanted to know very much about the origins, you know, who my great-grandmother was, who my great-grandfather was. Because I grew up with my grandparents, they lived with us as well, my grandfather lived with us. But I knew very little about them because they were such a quiet family. They said hardly anything to each other, which was in great contrast to my mother's family, who's, you know, consists of her six brothers and sisters. But as it says in the book, you know, when you marry into a Ceylonese family, you don't just marry the brothers and sisters, you marry the cousins, 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 and the aunts, aunts, second aunt. So very extended family.
Same for Malayalis, I just need
yes.
to add.
So this contrast was very interesting to me. But I knew that we came from a very fascinating lineage. The Peranakans are very interesting. And I just felt it was very important to tell the readers out there, how complex and complicated we are, including himself. And there are, of course, lots of personality traits and lots of positions he takes today on very public things that are rooted in his own personal experience. Only thing was, he couldn't write it himself because he's a beautiful scholar. I mean, his scholarship is just, you know, the style and everything. But the moment it came to writing his autobiography, it was very boring. but
clinical.
he's very technical. I was born on such and such a day. But he is like most Asians, I think, great storytellers. So the oral tradition still lives very strongly with us. And it was wonderful to just capture that over a series of recordings and interviews, which were then prepared in text, which he then went over. And that's how we got
it.
The book, yeah.
Okay. And I suppose the other thing is, how did you guys actually work together? I mean, did you sort of then once your dad told you stories, did you then go and try and corroborate these stories with, you know, your relatives who are still around? Was there that sort of fact-checking, if I can use that word?
No, we didn't have to do that. He merely submitted the questions 2 or 3 days in advance.
Well, really? Like a, like a journalist interviewing?
Yes.
So your journalism training came in.
Yeah, we had quite some nice sessions, though. Because, you know, life being what it is, there are so many coincidences that take place. For example, the man who was eventually asked to dissuade my father from marrying my mother at a time when inter-community marriages were not so, you know, prevalent.
Your uncle, if I
was my uncle, who happened to be my father's oldest friend. they've known each other since the age of 8. And then they met in university again, became good friends. And then eventually my uncle married my mother's sister. And my father married my mother. But it's how, you know, think coincidences, I mean, lives cross. I mean, your oldest, one of your oldest friends and good university mates eventually becomes your brother-in-law. I mean, these are things that only real life can offer.
There's something else, which I've not often told people. Later on, I found out that when my father began his career as a government servant, yep, and stationed in Batu Gajah, in the evening, he used to play badminton with a Slonis man. And that Slonis man was my wife's grandfather.
Oh, my word.
And this was way back in the 30s. You see?
It's written in the stars, yeah. Professor, I think.
No,
so.
And that's why I think autobiographies are wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, autobiographies can go two ways. One is it can be an act of self-justification, or it can be an expression of real love. And I think this is a case of the latter, where it's really about expressing love for family, for country, and for just the way life unfolds in the way that my father does. I think another thing about this book that I found very fascinating was, you know, he's a very quirky man. He has a very interesting sense of humor, in that it's quite black, quite dark sometimes. And it's just said in a very... It's just stated as if it's a fact.
Matter of fact, yeah.
Yeah, and then when you read it in prose, it is actually very, very funny. His dislike for reading books, for example, he kind of really looks down on the habit.
Why is that, Professor? Why do you? I mean, you mentioned in the book that you...
Because I'm too used to reading books, history books, critically.
Okay.
So whenever I read a book, I try to find fault with the author's work. And so I can't just sit down and read it happily like that. You see.
But then I understand that you also prefer to read documents. I mean, as you're in your career as a historian.
Very much. I'm so used to reading documents. In fact, I'm still doing it. And I'm trying to get the young scholars to do the same thing. And I cannot persuade them. They're not used to it. Even when they are in history, you know,
yeah,
they cannot do it. But I find documents so interesting.
Because that's fact, right? Because I think you said in reading it's someone else's interpretation.
When you read a letter written by the governor of Singapore in 1926, he is not lying usually.
I'm speaking today to Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo K. Kim and his eldest son, Edin Koo, and we're discussing Professor Koo's newly released memoirs, which is titled IKKK, The Autobiography of a Historian. We'll find out more about Professor Koo's early life after this quick break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today are two very handsome gentlemen, Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo K. Kim and his son Edin Koo, and we are taking a look at Professor Koo's newly released autobiography, which is titled IKKK. So let's go to some of your earliest memories, Professor. And I think that when you wrote in the book, you said that was of the war and the Japanese occupation. But what are some of your most poignant memories from that time? I mean, I think you mentioned that your family were relatively unscathed from the kind of atrocities that were happening around the country at that time.
In fact, well, I have such, in a sense, happy memories about the Japanese. I used to admire them. But as I always explain to people, as they came into the jungle in Kampa, where we were taking shelter, my father went out of the house to look around, and he was almost killed by the Japanese. I said, luckily the Japanese soldier, after lifting his sword, changed his mind.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would hate the Japanese for the rest of my life. As it was, when they came into Kampa town, and then they started exercising, and they did a lot of things. I admired them so much, you see, because they were so disciplined. And in fact, I felt sorry for them later on when they surrendered and they had to work like scavengers, you know, along the roadsides. And they were made to run from one town to another. So many of them collapsed and they were just thrown into the lorries. I felt sorry for them at that time. But otherwise, I do have pretty good memories about the Japanese.
Despite everything that they did to, you know, the people around you, not
actually,
quite your...
Actually, when I think back, our own people were at fault. They betrayed their friends or their enemies. And the Japanese, of course, not knowing whether a particular person was accused of being a traitor or a collaborator was true or not. And later on, when the Japanese surrendered, and then the communists started taking revenge. And the way they took revenge was worse. They used to kill people, for example, by keep tying them up in gunny sacks and drowning them. That's what the communists did, which was worse.
And when the British came back, I think you also have quite fond memories of the British occupation.
The first soldiers who came back were Indian soldiers. The British brought Indian soldiers. And then they were so nice. They brought cigarettes and chocolates. So we used to run after the lorries. And they threw them. We picked them up.
And I think football was also a great love of your life, if I can call it that. I think you mentioned in your books a beautiful game. What sort of sparked that love?
My father. My father was not a player himself, but he was following the game for years. And he knew all the top players in the country. He knew how the game was played. He explained everything to me. And I became a footballer based on his coaching, actually. And he used to watch me play every game, you know, and always very critical of me. There were times when I was very angry. Why is he criticizing me all the time? But he just wanted me to be a perfect footballer. And in the end, I had a very good time playing football. Even when I became a teacher and I coached my school boys, they played so well.
And we almost lost you to a footballing career, as in, when I say lost, I mean the historian side. We almost lost you to becoming a...
It was 1957 that changed my mind. Because I wanted to be a full-time footballer, but they had not introduced professionalism yet. So in order to play football in those days, one had to leave school early, seek a job, a simple job, and then stay with one's parents, and then play football. On the eve of 57, we were all told, we who were in the senior classes, were told the British civil servants will be leaving. So if you have a degree, you'll be able to fill their places. So we thought, well, it was worthwhile going to the university. That's why I decided to postpone my football career and went to the university instead.
And you were the first in your family to go to university, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, practically the first.
And, I mean, how did that sort of impact? I mean, I'm sure your parents were so
proud. My father was the first to pass a school certificate exam. So I had to use him as a model and be the first to go to the university. And it was a big sacrifice for him, you see. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky. Actually, he found it very difficult to support me in the university. But just at that moment, he had a promotion. And he had enough money, at least to give me my pocket money every month. But that was not too much in those days. My pocket money in Singapore in those days was $60 a month.
Amazing. Mm. There's not even a day here these days.
And there's an interesting addition which I just discovered. I didn't realize that my father was also able to save money for himself because he worked in the Ipoh Turf Club. Selling tickets to punters and that he enjoyed horse racing. This is a revelation to me. I didn't know that.
It's kept a secret all these years.
Yeah.
And also, you mentioned your time in university, Malaya, in Singapore. That was quite a heady time. I mean, there was a lot of political movements. But you also wrote in the book that you showed neither sympathy nor antipathy towards these movements. Why was that?
Because I was not that much of a stranger to politics. You see, I went to an English school in the morning and a Chinese school in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And one of my Chinese school teachers was a communist from China. And he used to talk a lot about politics, you see. And we didn't realize what he was trying to do. But I always talked to my father. So at dinner time, I would tell him what the teacher said. And my father became very worried. Then he told me, "You stop talking like this," he said, "or I will stop you from going to Chinese school." So in a sense, that teacher educated me politically. So that when I went to the university, I did not fall for all these activities that these people were cooking up, mainly anti-government activities, you know. And the interesting thing is many of these so-called socialists in those days, in the end, became capitalists. That's a wonderful thing. Whereas we simple people, we were not socialists, but we never became capitalists either.
You became more of a socialist than them in the end, right? Mm. And you also wrote that in the history department was actually the first place where you began to develop a sense of curiosity about the subject of and the country, which, you know, previously had never disturbed your mind. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yes, because I didn't do history in school.
Yep.
It was only when I went to the sixth form class and I had to pick art subjects, because science subjects would require me to do lab work until the evening. I would have no time for football. But in the sixth form, history, the history syllabus was very simple. You merely learn a few things about British administration and all that. But in the university, we had a professor from Australia who was very involved in debates on the right approach to history. And he was very critical of the way the British officials used to write about Malaysia. So he encouraged us not to write Eurocentric history, mm-hmm. but to pay attention to Malayan-centric history. And I became very fascinated with that subject. And until today, I'm not tired of doing research.
Even at the age of 80. Yes. But do you think that we, I mean, they always say history is there for us to learn from our mistakes. But I think it was A.J. P. Taylor, he said that, you know, we learn about the mistakes of the past in order to make the same mistakes again. I mean, things are never the same twice. But do you think that an analysis of history can sort of at least provide comparative factors, useful pointers, I suppose, about what may or may not happen?
No, I think it's very important to use history to try to find out the truth. What is actually the truth? I have found out that so many things which are being spread around today are simply not true. See? For example, a lot of the situation today, let's take the positive part, the developed stage of the society. As I always tell people, before World War II, Malaya was the richest country in the entire British Empire. Mm-hmm. So you could see that the British did not just swallow up everything. They helped so much to develop the country. And the richest people among Malayans were the Chinese, you see. So the people benefited. Even the Malays and the Indians benefited. And so it is very important that the younger generation today should know how we became so successful.
And, you know, the British are always also blamed for sort of making us so divided in terms of our race. It's just something that you don't agree with.
They were not. Our people were torn. They were pulled apart by activities going on in China and India. So they were very... The Indians were very proud to be Indians because they were told by the Indians in India, anyone born an Indian must forever remain an Indian. Same thing with the Chinese. They say all Chinese living overseas are Chinese citizens. You are just overseas Chinese. So they were, until after the war, they were still very being pulled apart.
I suppose what then have you found most rewarding, and I suppose also what most frustrates you about your career in history?
My frustration is just that today the subject is being practically killed. People are saying history is not important, you cannot make money with history, everything is about making money. But I said, as far as I can remember, so many of the history graduates have become so successful everywhere, not just politically, many are in politics, but even as civil servants. There was, for example, at one time, the Inspector General of Police was a history graduate, and you can find them even in commercial firms. So in what way could one say that learning history is a waste of time? And then what's important is that when I was young, we were always taught good values. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we were always asked not to pay attention to is money. Because money is the root of all evil. So take it away, take it away, take it away. We were taught good values.
Do you think then that as Malaysians currently that we actually have a solid grasp of our history?
Not at all. I have friends who told me that their children ask them funny questions.
Funny meaning?
One son asked the father, why are we studying a people who are already dead? And then there are some who think they're very clever. They say, oh, history is about the conqueror, not the conquered. It may have been like that in the past, but it need not be, you see. See, and in the case of Malaysian history, the records are all there. You can find out what the truth is. You don't have to write only about the conquerors. You can even write about the people, and which is my emphasis today. I'm not so interested in the conquerors. I'm interested in the people. And our society is so complicated.
Very
complicated. The Peranakan Chinese of Penang and the Peranakan Chinese of Melaka are not the same.
I mean, we are all classified as Indians, for example, but within our community,
that is just not good enough.
Yeah.
Even the Sikhs
don't want to be called Indians.
Today, somebody looked at a photograph of a Sikh gentleman and said, oh, he's a Bengali. I said, no.
Common mistake here.
He's a Punjabi. Even among Punjabis, there are Punjabis who embrace Islam. Mm-hmm. 70% of Pakistanis are Punjabis.
Yeah.
And there are Punjabis who are Sikhs. And at one time in this country, among the Sikhs, there were three territorial groups, Maje, Malwe, Duabe.
I did not know that. Yeah.
Very complicated, you see.
Something I noticed about when you were writing about your the people that you met and, you know, all the people in your book, you tend to mention their race, which I didn't find a problem with. I mean, I suppose because they're all good people that, you know, you love. And so you often spoke about the wonderful relationships you had with them, despite your diverse beliefs. But you also wrote towards the end of the book that relationships among a nation's citizens unavoidably determines the viability of that society. And do you think we're doing enough to solve, you know, the very evident communal problems that we have in our country?
No, we are not doing it at all. Because what people don't realize is, it is not just economics that is important, but culture. Culture is the whole way of life of a people. And today we are not helping people of one culture to understand people of another culture. Those days, at least in English schools, we used to go to the same school. And we used to grow up together. But today, they are growing apart from one another. And it is so easy to cause trouble among them now. And that is very, very dangerous.
Just going back, sorry, Edin, we've left you out of this conversation for a while.
My book.
But just to go back to another big chunk of what makes up the book, your story about your family. I personally love the story that you told about how you met Puan Sri Rathi. Maybe you could share that story with us, those of us who've never heard it.
It was by accident. So many things happen as a result of accident, actually.
Yeah.
It wasn't planned. Right? And so many times her father tried to separate us. For example, he wasn't sure that my parents would accept her, you see. So her father one day went to my father's office and told my father, can you please ask your son not to see my daughter anymore? And my father said, no, I cannot do that. If you want, you ask your daughter not to see my son. And at that point in time, her father realized that my father accepted the daughter. And so he was quite comfortable after that.
And I think the only issue was that you, I mean, you were obviously a Chinese man and, you know, Kwan Sri was obviously a very Ceylonese lady.
But we, see, I grew up in a very multi-ethnic environment. Mm-hmm. This is where people are wrong when they say the British deliberately divided the people. They never did. In the government quarters, we all live as one big group. So my neighbors, among my neighbors, were Malays, Indians, Ceylonese, even Eurasians. So I grew up like that, and to me, every Malaysian was the same. You see, it did not matter whether he was Eurasian or even what we call Chindian. In my school football team, there was one Chindian, there was one Eurasian, there was even one member of para royalty in my football team. You see. So to me, growing up is very important.
And obviously, you've had three wonderful sons. Yeah. Edin, I mean, how did you feel about your father, you know, telling such personal stories about you? I mean, he called you a fiery baby, for example, and a troublesome child in school. You know, how did you take to sort of those outings of your personality?
Well, we are very honest in our family. You know, I grew up in a very, and this is a real tribute to both my parents, we grew up in a very liberal climate environment in which you were allowed to express yourself. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, I was a very tempestuous teenager. Well, I was a little delinquent. Let's be quite. I was quite a delinquent teenager. And my mother used to get into panic states. And my father would always be there, you know, and just say, oh, let him get it out of his system. Let him get it out of his system. I'll always remember that. And I look at some of my classmates today and see, like, you know, doing things that I did when I was 17 years old, except that they're about 50. So I can understand what it was all about. But yeah, we were a family. In fact, one of the things sometimes I kind of blame my parents for was providing us with such a wonderful home and family environment that was just so free and open that they didn't prepare us for what the world was like outside. So when I went into school, for example, I found it very hard to fit in because it was not easy being a mixed child. Whereas at home, you know, it was not just at home in my immediate family, but in the larger family, you know, it just seemed to be the most natural thing in the world. I grew up, for example, you know, raised by a Malay nanny. Yep. That's quite unimaginable these days, but she lived with us. You know, she raised me with her children as well, all in one house.
Yeah.
So for me, the world outside then has always been a problematic place till today, which is perhaps why I think I visit my family home every single day.
Just for that, you know, that's where your sense of community is. You know, there's no judgment. There's no, yeah, I can Absolutely imagine. Not. And you also mentioned that, you know, all three of your sons, very, very different personalities. And
very different.
It's amazing that you all share the same genes. But I mean, you took a conscious effort to let them, as Edin said, you know, just grow up as they wanted to and just to follow their...
My youngest son, for example, from very young, he decided to be an Indian classical dancer. Even my wife couldn't take it in the beginning. But I said, no, it is, you have to let him make his choice.
Yeah.
And actually, he became so good. He's one of the best in the world.
He's world famous. Maven Khoo. And your middle brother, Edin Rubin, he's a very accomplished writer and, you know, so much more.
Real celebrity.
Another thing that I was reading about was that you learned Bahasa Malaysia on your own.
Mm.
And I think P. Ramlee was one of the people who got you on that path. Could you tell me that story?
No, because I used to follow my parents to the amusement park in those days, every night, you know. And then I had a chance to watch Chinese opera and the Malay Bangsawan. So I chose the Malay Bangsawan because it was a different race. And I got used to the language. And later on, P. Ramlee came into my life. And I had Malay friends, and they used to sing P. Ramlee songs. So I asked them to pass me the songs. And so I learned the songs. So that when Malay became increasingly important, I was already ready to pick up Malay, you see. Yeah.
And I think there was one story I read how you were dressed, trying to look like P. Ramlee, and your son saw that old photo and said you look like James Dean.
He got very upset. He got very upset. But yeah, very styled after P. Ramlee.
And I remember you telling me a lot of this, Edin, before, that you think your father is just a very cool man.
Oh, he's very cool. I mean, yeah, it's not just me who thinks it. It's, you know, friends who were in the University of Malaya, you know, he's regarded as a tree in the university. And everybody considers, you know, him stylish. One of the very interesting things about the Singapore chapter, for example, I was very excited, you know, about his thoughts about, you know, Lee Kuan Yew and David Marshall and the communists. And, you know, he had nothing to say about those things.
Yes, I noticed that.
And I was like, well, but he had so much to say about cabaret life, dancing, Jogate Modern and music and cinema. And after a while, I just thought, you know, there's that whole aspect of our social life that we don't remember at all. And that is just so wonderful and rich.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've just paid too much attention to all these big political events while forgetting, again, you know, the wonderful social life that was so free and so open-minded and liberal at that time.
And what made
you know,
it
taxi
so wonderful.
Girls and things like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I suppose my other question would be, you know, what did you discover through this whole process? I don't know how long it took for you to gather all of this information.
Well, it took a very long... You know, the process is very interesting because the psychology has to be right. So you are constantly kind of skirting for quite a while. But eventually when we pinned it down, it took us about 10 days?
Hmm.
Yeah, about 10 days.
Really?
You know?
Wow.
And then it just flowed. It just flowed. And there were also wonderful times. I mean, there were some things, for example, that, you know, needed jogging. Mm-hmm. My father's memory needed jogging. So we got people together, his old students, his old classmates. I remember one wonderful lunch I had with my father's college mate in the University of Singapore. And I discovered that this man, you know, was one of my father's friends. Had a whole new life after his retirement, you know. He backpacked through all of South America.
Wow.
He traveled to the Himalayas. He did a 420-kilometer walk through the Pyrenees.
Wow.
Yeah, incredible. But also very nice to see old friends come together. And I say, as I put it, you know, as he puts it, to break bread and share memories. That was love. But, you know, a lot of the things were new to me for the first time. I mean, my whole ancestry, you know, the way my father, the kind of Chinese my father is and the way he looks at other Chinese, which has always been a problem, as you know,
yes.
Lots of controversy. But also just being able to capture his... I've always known this about him, that he has, as I said, a very eccentric sense of humour. And a very quirky way of looking at the world. And I've always known that through bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually see it consistently run through. I love the you know, when I asked him about his initiation into history, and he talked about a typewriter. He said, my first initiation into history was a typewriter and a Pitt's guide. Those old guidebooks, they had Pitt's guide,
yeah.
With which they taught me to type with 10 fingers.
Yes.
You know, the Quick Brown Fox?
The Quick Brown Fox jumps over the lazy dog.
Yeah.
What an interesting way of entering the world of history through a typewriter. But
and
that's
that
him,
is.
You know, and he's very cool. He's a very cool man till today.
And putting all of these, you know, these thoughts together, putting all into a story, you know, what do you sort of hope will come of it? Why did you want to do this?
It's a question I have to ask him, but I have my my point of view too. I think, you know, in the past few years, I have worked a lot. I think... He formulated the paper on national history.
Mm-hmm.
And national history, I've always found quite a monolithic thing. But I am very interested, like my father, very interested in individual voices. So I've been working a whole series of oral autobiographies. I did the one on Ibrahim Hussein. I'm working on the one on Tun Saleh Abbas. I couldn't let my father go.
No.
Because every voice has a tone. Every voice has a particular way of looking at the world. And I think it's so important now, 60 years after, to have the voices tell their own story about how this country was perceived and how it was built. and really what it was like, because it's changed so much. So I thought his voice was very important. And I think that autobiography is going to be a very crucial component of how we look at our history.
And do you think it will play an important role, you know, in this era of post-truth especially?
Yeah, I think so. I think also the personal element is very, very important.
And how about you, Professor? How did you feel, you know, once you read the whole book, everything put together in that form chronologically?
Well, I was hoping that it would have an impact on the society. Mm-hmm. And it looks like it has. To me, that's very important because we're always talking about nation building. And then every other day, you have people being encouraged to fight one another. It is so sad, you see. Because I grew up loving this country so much and would like to see everything go well as the years go by, you see. And I'm so disappointed because the young today are so ignorant of their own society and they're so easily instigated by naughty people. Okay? So I'm hoping that somehow something will happen and they will change the whole attitude because this was such a great country and it must forever remain a great country.
Yeah, I think, you know, just to add here, you know, my father has been a very institutional person,
yep.
Been with the university for 53 years, you know, one of the formulators of the Ruku Nagara, you know, presented the National History paper. All those things now have, as crucial as they were, seem to have no place in our contemporary life. We make only gestural acknowledgements of the Ruku Nagara, but it really does mean nothing. But what I thought this book would do was to remove the man from the institution and to talk about, you see, so there's so much misconception surrounding my father, pro-government or pro-opposition, you know, anti-this or pro-this, when actually he's always spoken the truth. And sometimes we don't like to hear, you see, how complex things are. But one of the very encouraging things about this book and one of the encouraging things about this whole process is the fact that he is really loved by very young people who appreciate that one of the big holes in their lives today is the lack of history, which then breeds a lack of a sense of belonging. And they go to him, basically, for lots of answers. You should tell Juliet how young people stayed up literally 3-4 nights without any sleep to edit this book and put it together.
They did, yes.
These are your students or?
No, they're his friends.
Young teens, you know, came together, yeah.
Wow, amazing.
And even at the launch of the book, there were many, it was a very touching launch because it was a gathering of luminaries, you know. My father's professor came from Singapore, who's 86 years old.
Professor Wang?
Yeah. Mm.
Professor Wang.
Yeah.
Mm.
Tuanku Sultan Perak was there, of course, who's a good friend of my father's and has been for years. But also half of it was young people who had come, bought the book, and really relished the experience of being in the midst of this great generational coming together, which I hope is what this book will be.
So, Professor, you just celebrated your 80th birthday. I mean, what's next for you? What are you up to? What are your plans for these next?
The important thing is to continue to do what I have loved for a very long time, to do more research and to write more on Malaysia.
Excellent. So yes. We look forward to more books from you then and more papers.
Definitely.
This book is one, and if I may add, and then, of course, we have our duties, all the young ones, you know. This is the first book of a series of 70 publications that will be published over the next 3 years.
70. Wow.
And all of them bilingual. My father was one of those who wrote half his you know, work in English, half in Malay, and they've never been translated into both languages.
Okay.
So we're putting all of these papers and essays and everything together. And there's also a second volume of his memoirs, which examines his intellectual and public life. It begins in 64 and goes on until now. And then there's a publication of his collected essays on Malaysian history from 1964 up till now. And then there are republications of many of his books and monographs and and things like that. So it's a big long-term project.
Wonderful. And where can we get our hands on IKKK?
IKKK will be in the bookstores this week. So by the end of this week, I think they should hit the shelves and they are available at all major bookstores.
Okay. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Professor Emeritus Tan Sri Dr. Koo K. Kim and Edin Koo, and we were discussing Professor Koo's autobiography, IKKK, The Autobiography of a Historian, which is available at all major bookstores. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and you've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.